you think when the CEO of a huge financial company who's paying these kids out of college very substantial salaries, he can't get them to come into the office if they don't want to? You think you as a brand are going to be able to dictate what a consumer is going to want?
Hi, this is the Interline Podcast, Episode 1, Intelligent Retail. I'm Ben Hansen, and that was the voice of my guest for this show, Dan Leahy, the co-founder and CEO of Makersites. He, like a lot of people right now, was talking about how fashion retail has been reshaped and what its recovery might look like and what that recovery is going to demand from retailers and from brands over the next 12 months and beyond. Now, in this episode, you're going to hear the two of us, Dan and I, do a lot more thinking about those questions. We're going to try and figure out together what implications the answers have for your business. And you'll leave this episode with some real advice that you can either start putting into practice today, or you can congratulate yourself if you're already doing. Now, retail is a topic we all care about in its own right. We create new products, and we source finished goods with the goal of selling them, after all. That's the target that all the daily hum of activity in your office, if you're back there, or on your Slack channels if you're still working from home like I am, that's what that's all aimed towards. And so who's buying and where and how and why is a big deal, even in isolation. But retail doesn't happen in isolation. What sells and where and why is also the key to decoding a lot of other variables. Financial planning, material planning, costing, creative design, technical development, sourcing, and so on. These are all anchored in what a bunch of different indicators, from prior season performance to the broad political climate, what those tell us consumers are going to want to buy at the time your next assortment lands. That's why intelligent retail is the theme of this, our premiere episode. It touches every process, and in turn, it's touched by everything that's happening in your own brand universe, and it's touched by all the forces that are roiling and shifting minute by minute out in the world. So, as we finish the first month of a new year unlike any other, retail's a more critical part of your whole enterprise strategy than ever before. And this also means that it's vital for retail to be as closely informed as possible by what's really happening today. And it's vital for retailers and brands to be able to make confident, data-driven decisions about how to meet what's going to be happening tomorrow. And that's where Dan and Makersites, the company he co-founded in 2015 with a friend of mine, Matt Field, comes in. The two of them set up Makersites as a response to the staggering volume of waste and pollution that was, and in many cases still is, being generated by the fashion industry's model of overproduction. That accounts for 10% of all global carbon emissions. Big industry, big footprint, you might think. But fashion's pollution problem is outsized compared to the scale of the industry revenue-wise. There are, to be blunt about it, bigger industries that pollute less, sometimes a lot less. And speaking from my own perspective here, it's not the scale of fashion that's the problem. It's the way fashion has historically worked. And that's what Dan and Matt set out to do with Makersites, figure out a way to reimagine assortment management by gathering data across the entire concept-to-consumer process, creating actionable insights from that data, and making those insights usable and useful for all the cross-functional teams that make up a brand or retail business like yours. 7 years on, Makersites is used by smart, consumer-obsessed brands like Madewell, Ralph Lauren, and New Balance, whose digital product creation journey we profiled on the Interline last summer. Those brands, and others like them, they use the platform Matt and Dan envisioned and built with the support of a fast-growing team to radically reduce both their economic and environmental waste by streamlining how they develop and deliver products to consumers. So, Dan, welcome. First things first, tell me a bit about your history in the retail industry and tell me a bit about what Makersites does, what your day-to-day looks like.
Thanks, Ben, and psyched to be on here. We're big time fans of the Interline here at Makersites, so excited to meet the wizard behind the curtain. So my name's Dan Leahy, co-founder and CEO at Makersites. My background in the last 12 years have been spent in and around inventory optimization and sort of tools that can allow brands and companies to better utilize their inventory and be much less wasteful in terms of their inventory that they're bringing to market. In terms of what Makersites does, Makersites works with footwear, apparel, accessories, and home brands throughout the world, and helps those brands dramatically reduce waste in their own process by being more consumer-informed and consumer-obsessed in the way that they bring products to market.
This isn't an episode that's directly about COVID, but it is an episode that's being released at what feels a bit like a turning point, right? I don't like tempting fate, but 2022 looks to be the year in which some countries, you know, especially Europe, the UK, North America, they start to put the acute phase of the pandemic behind them. I can't say everyone's happy with how we got to this stage, but, you know, here we are. And that brings a question with it. So are the next 11 months going to set the template for the years to come? You know, is the rest of this year going to define what the next few years looks like? Or are we still in a temporary recovery phase? And either way, what does that mean for brands and retailers? What's your take?
It's a great question. And I think there are a lot of dimensions to the question. So on the surface level, if you look at retailers and brands reporting the revenue numbers, you're seeing many have gotten back to kind of 2 years back numbers, and many are exceeding them, often with higher average unit retail. So achieving the same sort of revenue thresholds with even fewer products, which is something that we think is pretty great. But it's not all certainly back the way that things are. I think there are a number of ways where we are in more of a recovery mode, or things are really shifting. First, working styles, I think many, and we experienced with many of our brand partners, you created these processes to kind of get through a COVID period that, as you said, I think our expectations of its length and duration have continued to extend as we've been throughout this process. And so ways that brands decided to sort of piece together how they come together and how they bring together assortments and how do they shift to online replacement of some of the ways that were historically facilitated via in-person interaction. I think many brands that we're working with are seeing, you know, we held a number of these things together with duct tape, but it might be time to put a nail in some of these. Like, we need to build some formality around this and sort of some infrastructure and some longevity, because people aren't all coming back to the office. And even after Omicron, I think there's a lot of expectation that, I don't know, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, are we going to be done with surges? Probably not. And so I think some of these more temporary measures for changing the ways of working, which was the sort of industry term you heard again and again, I think that the prevalence of subsequent surges has made people think that we need to add sort of more permanence there. But there are pieces that we think are truly going to drive permanent shifts. And one of them is the shift to digital as a far higher portion of sales has led many brands that we're working with to make major investments of people and resources towards making their company more attuned to digital commerce as a leading edge of their business. Digital commerce produces far more data and creates far more opportunities for consumer obsession than selling through other channels. And leading brands and the brands who are on their front foot are really investing heavily in taking advantage of that shift. And that's not going anywhere. And even if the percentage of sales that's happening on digital channel comes back to earth a little bit from really high highs that's happened during the COVID, the shift organizationally to attune to that channel and orient processes to bring in products to market to that channel, that is something that is not going away, because the benefits to doing that are allowing those brands who are taking that step even more resources to continue to invest. It's really a virtuous cycle there.
Awesome. Thank you very much, Dan. And I think we're going to come back to the channel mix a little later on, because I know people who are listening to this are going to be curious to see how far that shift towards e-commerce, how far that shift towards digital is going to persist and what a rebalancing of the channel mix looks like. But I think you're absolutely right to say that the processes, the ways of thinking, the mindsets and things that have shifted and the opportunities, you know, it might not feel natural to talk about opportunities when it comes to a pandemic, but they do exist. And the brands that have taken the right actions over the last 2 years are the ones who are in the position to take advantage of them. One other thing, so thinking beyond the brand level here, one thing that seems to have changed pretty universally during COVID, inside fashion and outside, is there are people down to the individual level, people wield a lot of power right now. The last 2 years have seen some sweeping society-wide changes, but now so much of what happens is coming down to personal choice. We want to work from home. We want different product categories. We want new levels of convenience. We want, rightly, inclusivity in sizing, adaptability, and much, much more. So how is that shift being felt in fashion retail, where brands have been accustomed to being able to dictate so much themselves?
I think it's so right that you call out work from home as an example of how strong the shift is. I mean, since we started Makersites, we have always told brands, and we've sort of identified the problem in the industry, is that so many of the processes for determining what is brought to market by brands came up in a world where a brand's ability to dictate to consumers was just far, far stronger. I grew up in a small town in Maine, and when I'd go back to school shopping with my mom every single August, I mean, I would walk directly into the sporting goods store and I'd buy my back-to-school shoes. I'd walk into the Gap or J. Crew and I would buy my three back-to-school shirts. And like, that was the total addressable universe that I had for potentially buying products. It was really limited, and as a result, brands were very much in control of that path to purchase if you had that distribution advantage. And so the means of being successful and serving that consumer with much less choice were just very different than today, where, I don't know, yesterday I was wearing a t-shirt that's a Babar and the elephant t-shirt of him skiing, and it's a French saying about him going skiing. There's no way I could have found that in the world. And those are the sort of things that I treasure as a consumer now. And so yeah, I mean, it's shifted so much. And I think work from home, even outside of fashion, is a great example of that. You're seeing executives, I mean, you see executives on Wall Street are having a big problem right now, where every executive says, hey, I want you guys coming and working from the office. And everyone's kind of like, well, I don't know about that. And you are like, thinking about the CEO of JP Morgan struggles to be able to get early investment bankers who are a year out of college to come into the office when he says to come in, like, think of how big of a shift that is from 3 years ago. It is a profound shift in terms of what we expect.
It's absolutely crazy. I have friends who work in finance in London, and it's the exact same thing. There are mandates being passed down, and there are all the structures you could possibly put in place to make it safe to return to the office. But that doesn't change the behavioral shift that's taken place. It's not necessarily about safety or exposure to COVID. It's about a fundamental shift in what we want from the companies that we work for, and to a greater extent, from the brands that we engage with as well.
I totally agree. And so if you think that, I mean, you think of that, going back to that example, you think when the CEO of a huge financial company who's paying these kids out of college very substantial salaries, he can't get them to come into the office if they don't want to? You think you as a brand are going to be able to dictate what a consumer is going to want? Like, that is, it is just, it's not happening today. That shift is really profound on a societal level. And so yeah, that's exactly it. As a brand, you need to think about if it's not just getting the distribution to be able to convey my perspective on product, responsiveness to that consumer needs and being attuned to it and being set up to be able to deliver on white spaces that you're unearthing from consumers, that becomes so much more important. And some of the things that we're seeing brands tackle are, okay, what are the data sources that we can be using to ensure that our entire organization is attuned to the needs of those consumers? And how do we package that up in such a way that designers and merchants and planners and people who aren't necessarily like statisticians, they are receiving this data in a format that can actually help them to understand the consumer better and to serve that consumer better. But it's not just the information that has to be better. You also have to be set up to be able to deliver against those consumer wants and needs that you're identifying in a more efficient way than retail has historically operated. So the 18 to 24 month process that's built around a wholesale calendar in large part, and you have the pre-markets and the sample and iterations, and you have so many things that were built to be successful in a retail world that honestly doesn't exist in the same way anymore. And it has to be far more consumer-centric, but brands are wrestling with, how do I shift these really ingrained ways of working to be much more responsive to today's consumer? But it's not a should I, it's I must, and how do I do it? Because it becomes so clear that consumer is in the driver's seat.
So you mentioned a couple of things there, Dan, and I think one is the sheer size of the opportunity, the sheer size of the possibility space that exists for brands that are willing and equipped to really engage with these consumers in a different way, in a more organic, bi-directional, collaborative sort of way. And I think that's something that is going to hinge very much on the nature of the data and the volume of the data that those brands have available on those consumers. So could you give me an idea of, A, how big that possibility space is? How big of an opportunity is there in catering to consumers in this new way? And B, what kind of data do you need to be equipped with as a brand, as a retailer, to actually go and execute on that?
Yeah, great question. And that's something that that's what we've built our company MakerSites around. So certainly something I have a perspective on. So I guess a few things. First, over 75% of consumers today actively want to co-create with brands that they care about. So you have this consumer, yes, consumers aren't willing to be dictated to, but they are willing to be involved and they're excited to be involved. And so you have to do that in sort of in modern ways, and you have to have it not feel like, I just got off a United flight and they're asking me how was my flight. That's not it. Expectations are higher than that. But the point is, if you're able to engage in sort of a modern way with consumers in a way that shows trust, there's a lot of appetite for consumers to provide feedback. McKinsey's most recent State of Fashion report mentioned consumer engagement they see as the third biggest opportunity for growth in the segment. And so we see, like, what better way to engage consumers than in the product creation process itself for brands, because that is a time of tremendous risk-taking that brands are taking in terms of the conceptual direction for their line, where all the downstream teams are going to be spending their time in their meetings and their selling motion. And so what we enable brands to do is throughout the product-to-market process or the concept-to-consumer process, we let them systematically engage their end consumers, invite them behind the curtain, allow them to review some products that we're considering investing behind, and measure their response to those products. And what we see is that consumers jump at the opportunity to do that, and that you find some really rich data that these product teams can take advantage of. So, for instance, Tailor Stitch is one of our brand partners. They're based here in San Francisco, where I'm based. And they found that not only do these consumers represent a really rich data point that has helped them cut markdowns by 10% a year by helping identify products that are less likely to resonate and shifting their resources elsewhere, but they've also found that consumers who participate in this feedback process actually increase their purchase volume and purchase frequency with the brand. And so it is one of these areas where marketing and products don't have to live within silos within an organization. Being able to build a direct relationship with your consumers, one of trust, one where you are engaging them with some products that you are considering, it creates a better relationship with that consumer. They are going to have a stronger relationship with your brand going forward, but also is generating data that allows you to reduce the waste in the products that you're bringing to market. And so those sort of two sides of that equation can produce some pretty powerful results that flow directly to the bottom line for brands.
You mentioned risk there, and you mentioned the bottom line. So let's talk about both of those things, because the bottom line is where brands and retailers are really feeling the squeeze at the moment. You know, at the same time as all this wider change to brand-to-consumer relationships and to the fabric of society as a whole has been taking place, it's also been getting harder and harder to make a margin. Costs are up across materials and labor. Shipping and logistics bottlenecks, you know, they remain a serious force to contend with. And, you know, there are some consumers who are willing to pay higher retail prices to compensate for those higher costs, but that's definitely not a universal thing. It's not universal across consumer demographics. It's not universal across brand audiences. I wrote a piece at the start of the year where I said that the current conditions demand that retailers and brands have total confidence that the products that land in stores and distribution centers are going to perform. And that, at least to me, is the essence of intelligent retail. It's about being uncommonly smart about what to bring to market, and then being able to turn those sort of intelligent choices, intelligent assortment plans into products quickly, but without cost overruns, without waste, without compromises to corporate value statements. But this is all a big ask. So how do you suggest that brands really approach changing the way they think about the bottom line, changing the way that they, changing the results that they're able to generate from the products that they choose to bring to market?
It's a great question. It probably is the question for retail. And first to state, I totally agree with your premise, which is, yes, increasing AUR can play a role. And you're seeing that across brands in general. AUR is up across many brands over the last 2 years. So it's been a big part of markdowns have played far less of a role in the last 2 years. In some ways, you can say that was purposeful from brands. I think the reality in many ways was they didn't have access to enough inventory to be able to even tempt themselves into playing into the sort of cycle of overbuy and then markdown every single season. But for whatever reason, whatever cause you want to attribute that to, you have seen a higher AUR. But yes, I mean, the easiest and fastest way for brands to improve their margins and reduce their waste is to curb overproduction. And this is helping brands both reach their sustainability goals, which are becoming increasingly an ESG priority, or shifting from an ESG priority to a P&L priority. But it also is going to help drive direct bottom line impact. And so I think the way that we see it is you can be gathering actionable consumer data on specific products that are being considered, and that provides brands with much more confidence in getting to market with a tighter, more refined line where they are committing their marketing resources, they're committing their sales resources, they are committing what they stand for as a brand to a tightened set, a reduced breadth of an assortment that they can really, really stand behind and they have confidence is going to meet a consumer need. Compared to having less of that point of view, having more breadth, having your marketing and sales assets or resources spread across a much broader assortment, like that is going to be wasteful. You're going to get less out of the things that that you really should be standing behind, and you're going to introduce far more products and assortment into the market that aren't going to hit your sort of financial goals. So you see, I mean, there's $1.6 trillion of products that are invested in, or $1.6 trillion invested in new product inventory every single year. But at the same time, consumer product satisfaction is really at an all-time low. And you're seeing that in sort of brands' collections increasingly missing the mark. In 1980, markdowns as a percentage of retail revenue was about 4%. Today, it's up to 40%. And so you're seeing, while the industry needs to be going in the opposite direction, the trend line over the past few decades has been really towards this world of overproduction that is cutting into those margins. And we see reversing that be the single most important thing that the retail industry needs to tackle over the decade to come.
That's a pretty stark statistic, that markdowns one, because the flip side to that is that only 60% of products brought to market are sold through at full price, which is kind of staggering when you think about it. It's a majority, but it's only just a majority.
Absolutely.
We've talked a lot about data here. We've talked a lot about consumer data. We've talked a lot about using data to make informed choices about the products you bring to market, about the things that you create and how you position them. In case we run the risk of being vague, I'd like to add some weight to what you and I mean when we're talking about intelligent decision-making in retail and the data that drives it. So could you explain a bit about the principles behind what you do at MakerSites, what data you gather, how it's analyzed, and how it's turned into actionable insights? And kind of following on from that, how does having access to those insights empower brands and retailers to approach things differently?
Absolutely. So at MakerSites, we've reimagined assortment management to enable brands to test products throughout the concept to consumer process and gain data-driven objective confidence in the products that are going to resonate with their end consumer. So the way that it works is brands can survey or engage their actual consumers directly through their own channels or tap into our network of more than 45 million consumers around the world. We allow brands to tune into the direct real-time voice of their consumer, capturing specific detailed feedback on colorways, fabrics, pricing, and more to be able to shape the assortment that's based on consumer preferences and demand, not on hunches or gut instinct. We're able to do this this is all we do in terms of working with brands in our categories throughout their concept to consumer process. And so we've built a lot of sophistication in terms of how we can translate early purchase intent information that you are proactively gathering from your consumers tied to key decisions that you're making to the ultimate commercial outcomes that we've seen across the hundreds of thousands of products that we've tested with our brand partners. And so that allows us to provide some real confidence to many of these stakeholders who, it feels risky. It feels scary sometimes to take the sort of creative risks that are required to stand out as a brand these days and to move a brand forward. And so, yes, there's a bottom line impact to being able to confidently stand behind the products that are going to have the best chance of being successful. But there's also a real sort of personal benefit that if you're empowering the appropriate amount of risk taking among a product team, that's a great environment. That's an environment that's going to attract the best and the brightest to push your brand forward. And that obviously has a great long-term impact. So that's where we started. That's where we spent our first, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. During the pandemic, we also said, and what we're hearing from our brand partners is, it's great to have data throughout this process, but our entire internal process for bringing products all the way from concept to consumer has been turned on its head. Like, we used to get together every quarter to walk the line. Those flights are canceled and those auditoriums are closed. Those meetings aren't happening. We have to have a way to be able to do this in a digital and or hybrid world. And so what we built out were actually digital capabilities to do just that for stakeholders across brands to get aligned on the current state of the line, have that be obvious and clear and transparent throughout the organization, to consume together the feedback and the data that's been associated with those products so that everyone is working from the same page in terms of where there's confidence and where there's questions, then get direct downstream feedback from stakeholders who are going to be ultimately part of this process. Historically, that's been, as you probably know, a really milestone-driven, like, big reveal where those downstream teams get feedback. But today it can be much, much more compressed. And we're finding that once you digitize that process, you can get feedback from downstream stakeholders much earlier in the process and identify areas of alignment or misalignment sooner, which just drives a tremendous amount of organizational efficiency.
Now, let's talk about waste, because that's a metric that has a huge impact on a retailer's bottom line. Unsold product is not free to produce, and it's not free to dispose of. But it's also one of the major areas where the fashion retail industry continues to fall dramatically short of the sustainability standards that are being set for it, both self-imposed standards and from the growing number of region and nation-level regulators. As a retailer, that's two pretty clear-cut reasons to reduce your waste, but it's also two seriously significant challenges, right? Fashion has long accepted high levels of markdowns, disposals, and returns, and that's been a fact of life for decades. But the industry's also settled for serious constraints on supply chain visibility. Both of those things need to change in order to have a material impact on how we think about waste. But how? How do they change?
Yeah, it is a topic that we're really passionate about here at Makersites, and I think it's one where we're in the midst of some pretty profound change. So I think maybe an anecdote to share how far the industry needs to come is, if you look at how many brands have their sustainability initiative live within the marketing department, a lot. And I think that is pretty symbolic of how many brands have thought about their responsibilities over the last decade of, yes, this is a cause that's important. It's one of the sort of ESG causes that we are going to stand behind as a brand, but we need to effectively check the box or do enough that we're not ending up on the front page anywhere for any misdeeds. But that is, I mean, that's a bit cynical, but that is really how many brands have approached it.
I think it's pretty fair, to be honest. I think there's a degree of cynicism that's warranted when it comes to the way that sustainability, CSR, ESG has been approached at, let's just say, at an industry level in the past.
Absolutely. And then the other flavor of it, which is perhaps a little bit better, but is thinking about it purely as a materials challenge. And so many brands have introduced capsule collections of sustainable goods, which are great and create awareness. And maybe it's on reducing plastic waste or vegan materials for running shoes. And those are great for calling attention to what's possible. Often they're at a higher price point. But it's good from an innovation and marketing perspective, but it's not holistic. And you think about the breadth of a brand's line, and if I have 10,000 styles and 10 of them are sustainable, great, I guess. But that was maybe good and hitting the bar 10 years ago. But it's unacceptable today. And it's unacceptable, I don't say that in an abstract sense. Consumers are finding that unacceptable. Employees within brands are finding that unacceptable. And to your point, regulators are increasingly considering that unacceptable. And so the last piece we believe is going to be one of the drivers from this shifting from an ESG consideration to a profit and loss consideration. There is likely to be legislation in the next 1 to 3 years that ensures that brands are towing the line in alignment with Paris Accord and other kind of cross-national commitments related to climate change that's going to meaningfully incentivize, and I say incentivize by threat, meaning threaten with fines, huge fines, brands who are not able to holistically reduce their footprint. And doing so is going to require a true cross-functional effort. And I think many brands don't even know what their baseline is. So we believe over the next few years, there is going to be a realization that what has been done in the past is just scratching the surface of what is going to be not nice to have, but truly required for brands in terms of showing that they are radically reducing the amount of environmental impact per unit of profit and per unit of revenue that they're bringing to market. I think this will be one of the biggest themes over the next 5 to 10 years. And I think it's happening a lot faster than many in the industry may have thought it was.
From a data point of view, you mentioned that this consumers will not accept low levels of genuine compliance, confident compliance from brands and retailers. Regulators won't either. Again, as a data-driven company, do you have any statistics that can really back up and really substantiate the size of the addressable market of people who deeply care about these kind of things?
Absolutely. It's something that we're continually studying, and these longitudinal studies are showing the growth in true consumer care for these sort of topics. So we recently ran a sustainability survey, a pretty nuanced one with North American consumers. We found that over two-thirds of consumers are more likely to purchase from brands that with sustainable initiatives than those without. And 55% of Gen Z respondents said they'd refuse to shop from brands without bona fide sustainable initiatives. And so you are seeing not only a high level already of people who care here, but that growth in the amount of people who care and the bar that is being lifted in terms of I wouldn't even make a purchase. It's becoming binary that I wouldn't engage with a brand that I don't align with here. You're seeing that happen. Where we think there's even more that's going to come is, I mean, you mentioned in the initial question, all of us in the industry know that markdowns has become a way of life within this industry. I'm not sure exactly how much consumer awareness of that cycle of overproduction leading to markdowns and how much of a percentage of the footprint of brands is driven by that cycle. People in the industry know, but I think people outside are just sort of wising up to it. But I would not bet against consumers' increasing understanding of what are the true drivers of footprint within industry. You are seeing the bar that consumers have for what is greenwashing go up and up, and they are holding brands to account who are not meeting that standard. So I believe, and honestly, I think it would be a great thing if consumers are more wise to exactly this cycle of overproduction that's rampant in the industry and has been accepted as industry standard, but if not reversed, will really make it difficult for brands to meet the environmental and footprint improvements they need to help shift the tide in terms of climate change. And so I think we're going to enter a new chapter there. The activism on the consumer side is only increasing, as our report was showing. But I think the way that they're going to come down on brands and their education and knowledge and what they translate that in terms of their demands, I think that is going to continue to accelerate, to become more specific, particularly tied to the overproduction piece.
Obviously, we're talking about retail here, but we don't want to talk about retail in isolation. A retail strategy drives merchandising and vice versa. It has the same relationship with design, with planning, with costing, with sourcing, and so on. So when we're talking about using data to make better informed retail decisions, we're really talking about a cross-departmental effort on the part of brand and retail businesses, and probably a cross-continental one as well when collaboration between brands and suppliers enters the mix. I mean, irrespective of whether you're making your own products or you're sourcing finished goods, you're still dealing with agents, you're dealing with factories, you're dealing with material suppliers. So if you, Dan, if you were to put yourself in the shoes of a retailer that wants to make better use of either data they already have or data they can obtain from consumers, how can they start to really make use of that data and the insights that that creates to make smarter, faster choices by disseminating those insights, disseminating that information in-house and in their supply chains?
It's a great question. And a brand that comes to mind for me is Hoka running shoes. So Hoka is a great example of a brand that's really leaned into consumer obsession as they think about modernizing their entire concept to consumer process. And so part of the ways they do this is consumer data. So they use maker sites to test products, to get confidence behind new conceptual direction, to identify the colorways that are most likely to resonate. So they're using that throughout the process. But you throw in a global pandemic that eliminated travel and in-person milestone meetings, and you really have a struggle to get the amount of internal alignment required to then be able to be in sync with your supply chain and bring products up to market in a timely fashion, and products that you know are going to sell. And so Hoka recognized the opportunity that the pandemic presented and leveraged it as a catalyst for change in some of their internal processes for coming to consensus related to or getting to conviction related to elements of the assortment and being able to communicate that to supply chain. So what that means in practice is divorcing themselves a little bit from a milestone meeting. If you are waiting to be achieving consensus and conviction to these key seasonal milestone meetings that have historically really guided the concept to consumer process for brands, you lose the opportunity to preemptively communicate with the supply chain and factories with capacity the products where you do have conviction. And so you have these kind of bulk orders and bulk communication that has kind of become the norm within retail, whereas there's an opportunity if you're driving better efficiency in communication within your company to be able to get to that conviction earlier, identify, hey, the consumer is behind this product, our different regions, downstream regions are behind this idea. We can communicate today to our factory partners where we want to go here so they can get going there. So in terms of kind of capacity utilization, in terms of communication with sort of those external partners, the faster and the more confidently you can get to conviction in terms of how the assortment comes to life and do that iteratively versus in these these bulk milestone meetings that have historically populated this process, that creates a much healthier relationship that makes you far less susceptible to these supply chain shocks. When a supply chain shocks occurs right before or after you are having this kind of biannual full commitment to your assortment, you're really in a difficult position. And so we think the resiliency introduced by being much more agile in that process, you see the impacts it has and challenge supply chain moments like the one that we're in.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I mean, everybody who's been in a brand environment will be familiar with the fact that, you know, planning, design, sourcing, all of these things kind of happen concurrently and then get smushed together in a process of trying to reach, like you said, trying to reach a final commitment, trying to reach a final decision. And if you're able to do that technical term, smushing things together, on the basis of real actionable data, real actionable insight, then, like you said, you can get to that commitment faster, but you can get to it with greater confidence, which brings us back to what we were talking about earlier, which is the requirement to really have confidence in the choices you're making and the choice and in the products you're bringing to market.
Absolutely. And as you said, it's not just one direction in terms of your communication with supply chain. So many of our brand partners over the last 6 to 12 months get notification from their factory partners that, hey, like, we're not able to satisfy the capacity that you have right now. And you need to cut 20 million pairs out of your plan. What are you going to cut? And so all of a sudden it's like, whoa, I need to make this decision in the next week of a dramatic reshaping of my line based on external factors. Like, how do I get to that confidence quickly? And it's if you're tied to a process that's historically you get everyone together and you hash these things out in a room and it's somewhat top down in terms of determination, that's flawed in general in a lot of ways, but it's also very limiting in your ability to react quickly to either challenges on the supply chain side or opportunities that you're seeing on the consumer side. And so that agility and resilience really allows you to be more nimble as a brand, which is just so important and critically important in today's retail landscape.
One of the biggest questions that's hanging over the retail recovery right now is what the channel mix is going to look like. Obviously, we saw a huge pendulum swing towards e-commerce during COVID, but it's hard to say at this point how far that's going to swing back, like if at all. But at the same time, there's a lot more to selling digitally than just shifting the point of transaction online. Like when you and I have chatted in the past, you talked about the need for brands and retailers to be digitally ambitious. And this feels like the right time to really pick that idea up and investigate what it means. So what's your take on what the channel mix of 2022 and beyond looks like? And what does being a digital retailer really mean today beyond just showcasing products and taking payments online?
I think it's such a great distinction there's the channel mix in terms of dollars and how many dollars are actually transacting on within brick and mortar versus on a website. But there's also channel mix in terms of influence within an organization. And I think both have seen sort of profound changes, but maybe I'll speak to both of them a little bit separately. So in terms of what the actual mix is in terms of retail revenue that's happening digitally versus brick and mortar, I think it's anyone's guess. I mean, I think it will not return to pre-pandemic levels, and it'll probably come off a bit from the highs it had when all stores were closed. I think that's probably not going to surprise anyone in terms of being this big reveal. I think the point is less to determine exactly where that is going. The trend lines are, even pre-COVID, are abundantly clear that digital is the channel of the highest growth. But exactly where that lands, I think, is anyone's guess. But to your point, V1 of doing well in e-commerce is ensuring that your site works and that your distribution centers are well set up and you have the sort of basics. But that's not enough to be successful in today's digital commerce world. You have to be able to have, like, for instance, are you set up as an organization where your own digital channels play second fiddle to your key accounts? For many brands that have come up in traditional wholesale, the answer is yes. And so that is things like digital channels can't even get exclusives. Digital channels can only access the inventory that's been adopted by the brick and mortar teams, direct teams in their region. Like, there are digital teams who are trying to merchandise product for consumers have been at a structural disadvantage in terms of where they sit in the process. And a basic step is getting them to parity there, but that hasn't even happened at a lot of brands. But even once they're at parity, this isn't just like my now representing my best account. Digital has so many opportunities, but also it's a different competitive field for brands. You have to be faster in digital. You have to take advantage of the proximity you have with your actual consumer to take that data that it generates and flow that back to the rest of your team. If you work within an organization where your digital commerce channel has been growing over the last 3 years and your job hasn't gotten easier and it hasn't become easier for you to achieve confidence in what you're going forward with on a product, you're not doing it right. And there are brands who I guarantee you are doing that right now. And those are the ones who are having a lot of success. And so being able to set yourself up as an organization where the digital commerce is a leading edge of the company, it is a first priority in terms of how it gets merchandising, but you're also taking advantage of all the insights it is generating, rich data, scalable insights at that point of transaction and flowing that back to your organization to be able to help them make more informed decisions. That is the sort of infrastructure that the biggest brands, the brands that want to be on their front foot for this shift, are dramatically investing behind. And you're seeing that bear fruit already. And that is going to continue to be the strategy there.
Now, at the Interline, we're very much about how to put technology and technology-adjacent solutions into practice, how to take theory and really start to make a difference to the businesses of the brands, retailers, suppliers who read our content and now who are going to listen to this podcast. If you could give one piece of advice to our listeners about how to make a quick way to make a material difference to the retail strategy, the performance this year, what would it be?
If I had to boil it down to one, I would say any brand that's achieved any sort of scale has done so by being consumer obsessed. But consumer obsession has sort of different definitions depending on which era of retail we're in. And in an era where digital commerce is taking off like it is, consumer obsession today requires a brand to make investments and make commitments in ensuring that their digital commerce experience that they are providing to their end consumers is actually also making it easier for your own teams to become competent in what they're bringing to market. And so if you had to invest in one thing, I would say it's investing in tools or capabilities that allow you to take direct consumer engagement driven through your digital direct channels and translate that into learnings about what your consumer is looking for so that you can be put yourself in the best possible position to deliver them an assortment that is going to hit your margin targets, that's going to reduce your sustainability or environmental footprint and ultimately really resonate with your end consumer.
Awesome. I think those are some great action points. Dan, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been great to have you.
Thank you, Ben. Thanks for having me.
That marks the end of our first episode. This has been a milestone a while in the making. If you've encouraged us to do this podcast sometime over the last 2 years, we heard you and we really value your support. And if you're new to the Interline, welcome. You being here, listening to this, it means a lot to me personally and to everybody else here. You set aside a portion of your drive, or your walk, or your run, or your flight, or your leisure time for us. And there's really no better way to support what we do at the Interline than that. We're going to be releasing new episodes of the Interline podcast monthly from now on. So if you found value in what you just heard, you might want to bookmark, subscribe, follow the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever service you use to listen to audio that isn't music. After the end of February, we're going to be capping off our coverage of the data-driven supply chain. And we already have some great guests lined up for that discussion, so it's one I'm looking forward to. In the meantime, keep checking out the Interline for editorial, interviews, and collaborations. The world of technology for fashion moves really fast, especially now. So while these monthly summaries are going to be a great way for you to stay briefed on the key takeaways from every topic we cover, there's a lot more that's happening week on week as well. So consider bookmarking the website and consider following us or me or both on LinkedIn. For now, though, enjoy whatever's left of your day. And I look forward to talking to you again next time.